Hello, I'm Kate Jabot. Welcome to SITREP, your weekly look at the big issues in defence and world affairs. A new wider service medal is to be awarded to servicemen and women on some operations which don't meet current risk and rigour thresholds. But is it a reflection of modern military service or an award for just doing your job?
We certainly don't want to go down the American track where you get medals for absolutely everything. But the principle is already there that service is recognised. So for those who don't like it, probably just button up and get on with it.
It's more than 20 years since British ground troops last went to war against another country's armed forces. But how did Iraq shape the army of today for their next state-on-state war?
This is where we started to see the technology really evolve and get clever fast.
And a big military retirement. We look back at the contribution of the Apache Mark I attack helicopter over two decades.
It was a huge step change. Being able to perform all of the functions just as two crew and an arsenal of weaponry on board allowed ultimate protection for ground call signs that were potentially under fire.
SITREP with Kate Jabot and Professor Michael Clark.
So this week we're talking about a new military medal, the Wider Service Medal, and it's certainly got the internet talking. Tell us more, Mike.
Yes, the government announced this week that they wanted to introduce this Wider Service Medal for work that was not operational in the operational sense of being at a high level of risk or requirement, but operations which are more continuous. And of course, the obvious one is continuous at-sea deterrence, nuclear armed British submarines, which are operating all the time. They're always there. That and other Air Force jobs, I mean, you know, the British military are spread so thinly these days that a lot of people are working very hard all the time on operations. So that's the thinking behind the medal. But remember, I mean, medals are comparatively recent. I mean, Waterloo, the Battle of Waterloo was the first real campaign medal that was awarded. There was a sort of a military, what was called the Army Gold Medal, that was regarded as the Peninsular Medal, that was awarded from 1810. But it wasn't really till 1815, with the Battle of Waterloo, that was such a horrendous battle. It wasn't so strategically important, but it was such a landmark battle in British thinking that that's when medals, campaign medals, started to be created. And as they were created, of course, they have to mark campaigns that were more and more distinctive and more dangerous, more and more decisive. And so the government's kind of taking a step back and saying, well, we should mark those aspects of service which may not be so dramatic, but actually are just as important. That's the thinking behind it.
So who will get it and who won't?
It will go to those members of the armed forces who have been serving in a range of functions. So, you know, doing airdrops, air support, quite a lot of naval operations, which do not actually fall under the category of Iraq or Afghanistan or any of the other campaigns that have been taking place. I mean, if it does fall under those categories, for instance, it was 25 days in Afghanistan, that if you were in Afghanistan for 25 days, then you're entitled to the Afghan medal. And which is why a lot of the tours were 5 weeks, the very briefest tours. I mean, the army were very keen to send people out for at least 5 weeks, so they got the medal. So they fell within that category, even if they were doing something much more general, but that bit of it required them to be in Afghanistan. It was slightly absurd in that respect. But it's for people who are working on lots of other things. And when the British Army and other services are doing so much all the time, then there's a sense in which, well, we ought to recognise the service which those people put in, which isn't so dramatic.
Well, we'll get into the weeds of whether this Wider Service Medal is a good or bad idea in just a moment. But we just wanted to get some brief context before we do with one of Britain's leading experts. Peter Duckers is a former curator of the Shropshire Regimental Museum and has written more than 20 books about medals and their history.
The British system has given medals for all sorts of service, mainly for combat service and war service. But there are also medals for jubilees and coronations, long service, meritorious service, gallantry awards. There's a whole range of medals that's been awarded over the past 200 years, really.
And what is different then about a wider service medal?
Well, the British system was not really rewarded with medals service personnel who are not in combat. They've normally been related to war service or combat service. So this one is rewarding dangerous or hazardous work that's not necessarily under combat conditions. Now, It's been going towards this direction for some years. There have been a number of medals awarded, for example, restoration of Iraq, work in Afghanistan, etc., etc. So we've been going towards the idea of giving people who are under dangerous circumstances a medal to recognise the hazard and the dedication. So this new medal, I think, formalises that. It is now a medal that will reward people for doing more than their job, but not being in combat.
And one newspaper has described this as a world first. Is it?
It's difficult to say because different medals are awarded by different countries under different circumstances. But I think, generally speaking, yes, as just a medal for this sort of wider service that isn't in combat, it's probably very distinctive.
And do you think this development changes the meaning of medals?
No, I don't think so, because we've always awarded medals for all sorts of different circumstances. This is just widening the circumstance for non-combat medals, I think. It's formalising a wider situation, if you like.
Really good to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time, Peter Duckers.
OK, thanks.
Well, let's get the thoughts of General Lord Dannett, former Chief of the General Staff. Lord Dannett, great to speak to you. Is this wider service medal a good idea or a bad one?
I think it's an interesting idea, and I think it reflects where we are in defence today. We've got used since the end of the Cold War, when most service people probably only had a Northern Ireland medal, and that was it. Since the end of the Cold War, when we saw the first Gulf War and the Balkans, and then so many other conflicts, Iraq and Afghanistan in particular, subsequent to that, that we've got a generation of soldiers, sailors, airmen and marines with really quite a chest full of medals. But that's pretty much stopped since 2014 when combat operations finished in Afghanistan. But the armed forces have been extraordinarily busy in the last 8 to 10 years, and on the face of things will remain so. So I think it's innovative and probably sensible to recognise the commitment, the time away from home, and just the effort that goes into the sort of deployments, whether it's a deployment in a ship or whether it's a battle group in Estonia or Poland, that people have been going through, and giving them something to wear on their left breast with pride. Yes, it doesn't have the rigour of a medal earned under fire, but I think it does recognise service, and I think that's legitimate.
And of course, not everyone is going to like it, as you'd expect. Some of the comments on our social media, for example, go along the lines of a medal for turning up, how American. And even if this isn't wokeness at work, I don't know what is. What do you make of those kind of responses?
Well, I can understand that. And I certainly thought about it when I first heard about the Wider Service Medal. To be absolutely honest, I don't like the name. But I think Wider Service, it doesn't kind of do it for me, really. But I think I'd go back to my original point that we certainly don't want to go down the American track where you get medals for absolutely everything and you see people with chestfuls of ribbons and you really wonder what on earth they've done. But we are moving into a generation where a lot of service people will probably have no medals. I mean, you see some people and the only medals they're wearing are Diamond Jubilee and Platinum Jubilee medals. And so I've got a coronation medal. Now, I'm not decrying any of that, but I think having a device whereby people's commitment and service is recognised. After all, the Long Service and Good Conduct Medal is not a medal awarded under fire. It recognises service. So the principle is already there that service is recognised. So I think for those who don't like it, probably just button up and get on with it.
So what is the danger, though, of devaluing the medals that people have earned up until now for putting themselves in harm's way?
No, I don't think there's any danger of devaluing. If people have got a Falklands medal or they've got a Northern Ireland medal or an Iraq or an Afghanistan medal, we all know what those ribbons indicate. And you wear those with pride. This other medal, people will increasingly get to recognise the ribbon and the medal itself, and we'll know what that represents. So I think, a bit like a broken record, I'm coming back to say, I think on balance, this is a reasonable way of recognising and rewarding commitment on operations, although they're not operations in the face of the enemy. And I think this is an important part about what we're doing in the armed forces these days, and that is deterring future conflict, deterring future war. And that is a very legitimate role for the armed forces to fill. We all know the disastrous cost of fighting wars, even disastrous cost of campaigns like Iraq and Afghanistan. Far better to be deterring at a much cheaper cost in the interests of peace and stability. So I think recognising this kind of service is legitimate.
It's quite interesting that you said earlier that, you know, you don't want to get into the realms, though, of getting a medal for absolutely anything. What do you think that the sort of the threshold should be?
Well, I think the threshold is probably about where this one has put it, when there is quite an extended period of qualifying service on deployed operations, or I'm going to say deployed deployments. And the sort of thing I'm thinking about are the 6-month deployments of army battle groups to Estonia or to Poland. I mean, that's a long time away. It requires pre-deployment training. There's pressure on families. And I think it's right that a device has been contrived to recognise that form of service. You think about submariners in the continuous at-sea deterrence. I mean, there's one of the submarines has recently come back from an extraordinarily long deployment under the surface. Well, I think that's an achievement that should be recognised.
And there are going to be people who served their country in the past who have not had medallic recognition for what they did, who may feel that their contribution is more deserving and that this is a bit of a slap in the face.
Well, yes, I understand that. And I've had lots of letters over the years from people who think there should be a Cold War medal. And let's face it, that's an extension of the point that I was making about deterrence, because we had a capable Navy, Army, Air Force that stood up to the Warsaw Pact, eventually, amongst other things. That was the reason for the Soviet Union to break up and the Berlin Wall to come down. But there is another principle which the Ministry of Defence and the committees that deal with medals very much stick to, and that's no retrospection. You know, decisions are made today about things that are happening today, looking forward to the future. If we were to start to look back, frankly, where would that stop? So the chiefs of staff of today will have considered these issues, would have made a recommendation. Secretary of State and ultimately the sovereign will have approved it. And we are where we are with the wider service medal.
Lord Dannett, great to speak to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Kate.
And Mike, just going back to your point about people being sent to Afghanistan for 5 weeks to ensure they got the medal, this wider service medal has a 180-day requirement. That's 6 months on a single deployment.
Yes. And so, as Lord Dannett was saying, it's an attempt to say, look, you can't get it for nothing. You have to get it for something which requires dedication over a fairly long period. And there's quite a lot of people, of course, who will qualify for that. And I think there's an attempt here to set the threshold reasonably high, but not so high that that it loses any meaning, so that you can recognise lots of different people. And, you know, in Britain, we throw our weight against the sort of medal inflation which Lord Dannett was talking about. I mean, for instance, everybody who got the Afghan medal also gets a NATO medal because it was part of a NATO operation, but they don't wear it. By convention, you do not wear it on your uniform because it's not a British medal. But now, in other countries, you wear all of them. You wear absolutely everything. I mean, I remember once going to address the staff college in Uruguay, and I that afternoon, I'd seen the whole of the Uruguayan fleet in one corner of Montevideo Harbour, unable to go anywhere because they had no fuel. And the Uruguayan Air Force consists of two C-130 transports, one of which was stuck in Chile because they hadn't paid the maintenance cost to get it back. And I addressed this room of brigadiers, major generals, lieutenant generals, and they were dripping with medals, dripping with them. And I thought, what on earth have you got those for? And I wanted to ask one of them, tell me what your medals are for. Tell me, go on. And to be fair, the Uruguayans did put effort into peacekeeping. They did send a battalion to Somalia to do peacekeeping. But the reason they did that was because they got $1,000 per person per week for deploying on peacekeeping operations. And so that's why they did it.
Just to pick up, though, Mike, on some of the other comments from social media that we've had. There's an interesting one here, and it goes, so it's a medal for the RAF and Navy then, exclamation mark, which suggests they don't think it's a good idea. But actually, Mike, Is there a point here that this will have more effect for those services rather than the Army?
Yes, it will, because the Navy and the Air Force have been doing more of these sorts of operations than the Army has done. And the Army, I mean, as Lord Dannett said, has been extremely busy since the end of the Cold War. So these more sustaining operations that the Navy and the Air Force have taken part in, like Op Shader, for instance, you know, in and out of Cyprus with air power against ISIL, which is still ongoing, of course, those sorts of operations, those wider operations involve an awful lot of people from the Navy and the Air Force. So it will be more important to them. And I think that's fine. I don't have any problem with that myself.
And then there are many comments along the lines of, what about a pay rise? What about decent accommodation?
Yeah, and that's a whole other issue. The danger is that the award of medals will be seen as a cheap compensation for not putting right the things that the forces really do care about. And I think the MOD has got to take that one fully on board to say this is not connected with the offer that we make. It's not connected to the welfare of our service personnel, and we are addressing those welfare issues. But there's always a danger that people will be cynical about it, but that's not a reason not to do it.
This is SITREP.
We are, we're told repeatedly, now in a pre-war era. The last time our nation was facing such warnings of an impending conflict with another state was just over two decades ago, ahead of the Iraq War. History does not record the 6 years of combat and counterinsurgency operations as a success overall. But of course, nothing is quite as simple as that. SITREP's James Wharton has been examining how the legacy of the Iraq conflict shapes the army today for a new film, Adapt and Overcome. James, hi. The war part of it, state military versus state militaries, was over quickly. It's what followed that really defines it, isn't it?
That's absolutely correct. Iraq was very much a tale of two campaigns. There was this big conventional war at the start, the UK and the US versus Saddam Hussein's military, had the fourth largest standing army in the world at the time. And actually, that bit went rather well. The Allies, the coalition, the UK and the US, they won, and they won emphatically. What happened next is where the really interesting, you know, conversation exists. And that's the emergence of an insurgency. And with the insurgency came new threats. And that required the British Army to tilt from fighting conventional warfare, which it had been preparing for decades to do, very much a post-Cold War mentality, tilting to this counterinsurgency operations. And there was a gap. The military, in some respects, were caught a little bit off guard. I said that this insurgency posed different threats. Number one on that list was the IED, the improvised explosive device, also known as roadside bombs. And in this film that I've made, I spoke to a survivor of an IED attack called Chris Herbert. He was serving with the Yorkshire Regiment in 2007, and he was the snatched Land Rover he was on patrol travelling in was struck by an IED.
We'd been slammed, we'd been hit properly. So my right leg had gone. I died on the ground and then died in the helicopter and then died again in surgery, so cardiac arrest stopped. What actually happened was the daisy chain IED hit from the right-hand side of all three vehicles. So we were in three landies, three snatch. Driver was hit quite hard. And we rolled as well. We went up on two wheels, so we were rolling down the side. And the driver, I will never understand how, but got that vehicle back on four wheels.
Before he died?
Before he passed away, yeah. And the interesting thing about that is, you know, anybody who's been in a snatch is they are very top-heavy. They roll. They, you know, we are trained how to deal with the roll. I fundamentally believe that he knew that and kept that vehicle down.
As Chris says, his driver, Private Luke Simpson, died in that attack that day. It really was a problem. It was a serious threat, I think, back to my own time in Iraq. Our number one concern, the thing we lost sleep on every night, was this IED threat.
Mm. And ultimately, the toll of those killed and injured in snatch Land Rovers reshaped the Army's light vehicle fleet to what it is today.
That's right. The IED, in fact, becomes the number one killer of British soldiers in Iraq at the hands of the enemy. And an awkward statistic within that fact is that most of those soldiers died in snatched Land Rovers or in Land Rover variant vehicles. And these were minimally protected vehicles that soldiers were expected to go out on the ground and operate in. The UK government understood that this wasn't OK and that actually it was putting soldiers' lives unduly at risk by sending them out in these vehicles. So they turned their efforts and their attentions to finding better vehicles. And most notably, out of this problem emerges a really, really good vehicle called the Mastiff, but also others, Husky, Foxhound, Ridgeback. These are all vehicles that share names with dogs. And I was able to interview the general who was responsible for finding these vehicles, for finding an answer to the IED snatch Land Rover problem, Chris Wilson. He was the Master of Ordnance in 2006 at the Ministry of Defence.
Every time anybody was injured or very sadly killed in a snatch vehicle, I had to go to the minister and explain why this had happened. So there was a lot of pressure on me, let alone everybody else around me, to find another vehicle. In the case of Mastiff, it was the use of that vehicle by the US Marine Corps, and known as Cougar, that we alighted on that that vehicle.
And I was actually in Iraq in 2007 when the first Mastiffs rolled off the back of an aircraft and were delivered in theatre. And I just remember looking at them, me and my mates were absolutely wowed. You know, we were household cavalry soldiers. We were used to working on vehicles that were designed in the 1960s and 70s. And then we had these brilliant, you know, futuristic, really well-armed Mastiffs to use on the ground. And the important thing to note about these vehicles is they worked. They could, 9 times out of 10, survive an IED strike.
So, James, the vehicles were improved to resist those blasts, but what about preventing those bombs in the first place?
Yeah, well, you know, it wasn't enough to just say, well, we'll give you a better armed vehicle and hopefully that will be enough for you to survive a blast. The British also turned to science, to the defence boffins, to come up with some solutions. And actually, on the shelf, when this roadside bomb threat becomes much more common and everyday, we were able to look at technology devised much earlier in Northern Ireland, say, technology that helped soldiers in that conflict defeat IED technology. And it was called ECM, Electronic Countermeasures. And it works in a number of very clever ways, some of which we're not even able to talk about these days because it's that classified and it's that complicated. But essentially, the thing to know about ECM is that it has the ability to jam radio signals that might be being sent to a roadside bomb to explode. So if you can imagine, you're coming down the road on a patrol and you know, an insurgent sees you and decides to press a remote control to get that bomb to blow up via radio waves. This ECM technology had the ability to stop that from happening. I spoke to Justin Crump, who these days is a defence analyst, a renowned defence analyst. But back in the early 2000s, he was a troop leader on the ground in Iraq in the Royal Armoured Corps. And he spoke to me about his memories of that technological quest to find answers to defeat these problems.
You've got a big technological arms race going on, as I said, between the people trying to do us harm using a variety of methods and the devices and technology we can apply to try and mitigate the threat. The passive infrared threat was one of the first big step changes, I think, in IED capability that we saw. And that's why it's something we still talk about and that resonates with us. This is where we started to see the technology really evolve and get clever fast.
Justin Crump there is talking about our response to these threats, our technology getting clever fast. But, you know, the thing is, the insurgents, the IEDs that were being dug into the side of these roads were also getting cleverer by the day and fast. It wasn't a case of just sticking some explosives in the side of the road with a wire coming out the back and, you know, hoping for the best when they go off. These bombs that the insurgents were planting to target British soldiers were very sophisticated.
And the Iraq conflicts, along with Afghanistan, has also significantly shaped both the medical technology and procedures for those injured and battled.
That's right. Some of our contributors, Lord Dannett actually is involved in our programme. He says that, you know, because of the advances made in the field of battlefield medicine during our time in Iraq, there are hundreds of people alive today who otherwise would not be. The likes of Chris Herbert, who we just heard from a minute ago, who lost his leg in that IED strike. I think the big takeaway for me, Kate, is that the pushing down to lower ranks, to people like me, I was a trooper, I was 20 years of age when I went to Iraq, and I was also a team medic. So that was because the army understood that actually we shouldn't keep these skills, these battlefield medic skills, the preserve of just a chosen, highly skilled few. What we actually should do is we should try and make as many common soldiers as possible just a little bit more trained in how to deal with catastrophic injuries so that they can prolong life in theatre.
And, of course, the combat experience from Iraq is still in the army among some of the longest servers.
Absolutely. And, I mean, this is a bit of a double-bladed sword because it's great in one respect that people... My best friend in the army, he's 37, and he's a senior NCO now in a regiment. And by the time he was 23, he'd been to Afghanistan four times and had secured some significant experience under fire. Now, that can only be good for the armed forces today, that he's now in a senior position, in a command position, and he's commanding men and women who can look at him and understand and gain from that experience. But I suppose, and this is the other side of the story, that is time-limited experience. You know, my mate's 37, he's not going to be in the army for much longer.
So the army of today has been significantly shaped in terms of its light vehicle capability, counter IED, medical technology and also experience. But how relevant is all of that now? Mike, the whole point of James's work here is assessing how the army adapted from war fighting to counterinsurgency. So has it left the army in reasonable shape or bent out of shape for the next war it might have to fight?
More or less bent out of shape, I think, Kate. You know, during the Cold War, the thinking was that you prepare for war fighting and everything else you might need to do, you can do with a bit of adaptation. So counterinsurgency work, work in Northern Ireland, work in expeditionary operations. If you can prepare to war fight, you can do all of the other things just with adaptation. And then when the Cold War came to an end, the thinking changed. They said, look, we're not really all that good at peace support operations. We need to structure for that and structure for expeditionary operations. And we did. And now here we are with the army desperately trying to get back to a proper war fighting posture. And it's not very easy. So we ended up, I mean, as we said there, you know, with Mastiff and Husky and Foxhound and Ridgeback. I mean, the army has got rid of so many types of, I think it's something like 30 different types of vehicle to try to consolidate around Boxer and Ajax and the Challenger 2, Challenger 3. And that's a long process. So the army is still bent out of shape as it now tries to recreate its genuine warfighting capacity at divisional level. And that's going to take some time.
And James, this, as you've said, is personal to you in a way because you served on that counterinsurgency mission in Iraq. I wonder how relevant you feel that experience would or wouldn't be to fighting the kind of war we see in Ukraine right now.
I think it's a mixed answer again. I think it's great in the immediate aftermath from significant combat experience to be able to at least put yourself at a macro level across the service, soldiers who have a mindset to be able to take on combat. I think that's valuable. But like Mike said, and almost all of our contributors to the documentary argue that while it was the right thing to do to bend to counterinsurgency operations to tackle these really significant threats like the roadside bomb, and there were other threats, and of course there is Afghanistan as well, it does put the army, and it definitely did put the army, they say, into this position as it emerges into this new world that it's fairly focused on these specific types of operations. And, you know, the great unknown was, what's going to happen next? And it looks like the next war will be much more similar to perhaps wars of the 20th century than the wars that we saw in the early part of this one.
And Mike, when we hear criticism of UK readiness for war, numbers of tanks, planes and ships are always brought forward. But what about, what of that modern protected light vehicle fleet? Is that what we might need for a peer-on-peer war?
Yeah, in reality, you always need something of everything. And so, yes, you always will need light vehicles, protected vehicles for quick operations of a more specialist nature, possibly. So, yes, you never need to re-equip with all one thing or all the other. The question is always the balance between, say, light protected vehicles and what Ajax is designed to do and so on. It's getting that balance right, which is the difficult thing. But you never get rid of a complete capability if you can possibly hold on to it. Whether you've got the right vehicle for that capability, you know, that's a different question.
Mike, something else that's been reshaped by Iraq is thinking. The Iraq Inquiry report ran to 2.6 million words. How relevant is that for the next big British military action?
Well, Whitehall still tries to keep it relevant because the Chilcot report that we're talking about is part of the thinking in all Whitehall decision-making on defence and security. It is said that there's like a sort of a column down the side of the decision documents, which is the Chilcot principles. Are we consistent with the Chilcot principles to avoid these sort of things and be clear about other sorts of things? So Whitehall does keep these things, I think, under review all the time. I think Chilcot has had a much bigger effect within Whitehall than it has in the wider public. But, you know, Kate, you know, I go around talking about defence and security at meetings and conferences around the world. And I would say we are 20 years on now from the Iraq operation of 2003, and I would say that not a month goes by without somebody raising the Iraq experience in a negative sense to talk about British and American defence and security policies. It still hangs on us 2 decades later that the whole thing was such a misstep, a mistake, and in some cases some people say it was illegal, which it wasn't, but it was certainly strategically mistaken.
And James, that Chilcot report, it sealed the historic verdict on the Iraq war as bad. But nothing is as simple as that kind of binary. Do you think there is some good in the way it shaped the army of today?
I think it's really interesting what Mike's just said. I completely agree with him. Last year, I was sent to cover the 20th anniversary commemorations that were taking place at the National Memorial Arboretum. As a reporter, I went there to cover it. And when I got there, I found that there were no crowds, there were no invited guests, there was a very junior minister laying a wreath on behalf of the government. And the clincher was they were doing all of this before the site was open to the public. We had to be there at 8 a.m, and they were getting this out of the way before anybody really turned up and saw what was going on. And it occurred to me that we are deeply ashamed of the Iraq war, to the extent that we were doing this memorial almost with a cloak and dagger and paying the most minimal of respect to what that conflict actually was, and of course the consequences on people like soldiers who lost their lives and their families. But there are things, there are positives that are lost in all of that sort of dark cloud, and they are military. The positives that the military can take and move forward with, and I think particularly in the field of battlefield medicine, which can absolutely be traced to the Iraq war, those positives will save lives in the next conflict, whenever that might be.
Thank you very much, James. And you can watch his film, Adapt and Overcome the British Army in Iraq, on the Forces News YouTube channel. Now, after 2 decades of service, the Army has just said farewell to a very distinguished servant. The Mark 1 Apache helicopter has played a part in some of the biggest operations of this century, providing attack capability from land and sea, not just with its chain gun, but also rockets and missiles. Like any long-term member of the military, it's picked up some nicknames along the way. Friend in the sky to troops relying on its close air support. Mosquito to others because of its distinctive insect-like profile. Perhaps the height of its fame was when Prince Harry served as a co-pilot gunner of an Apache in Afghanistan. It's not the end for the Apache, though. An upgraded version, the 64E, is replacing the Mark 1. Major Daniel Hunt, who's second in command at 656 Squadron, 4 Regiment Army Air Corps, is one of the pilots who's just flown the Mark 1 into retirement.
The Mark 1 Apache was brought into service in the early 2000s, primarily bought for a role in Afghanistan to support ground troops. It replaced the Lynx and Gazelle, so multiple platforms rolled into one. In her time, she served nearly 2 decades in Afghanistan. She has deployed to Libya under Op LME and maritime operations. She's been to America, Oman, Jordan, Cyprus, and most recently, the Arctic Circle, Norway, Scandinavia.
Can you just tell us a bit more about the capability the Apache Mark 1 has brought and the job it's done? Because ultimately, much of it is to support troops on the ground, as you said, in Afghanistan.
Yeah, of course. So prior to the Apache, the Army and the Navy were utilizing 2 different helicopters, analog helicopters, namely the Gazelle and the Lynx. The Apache is a digital platform. Has had the capability to roll both roles of the Gazelle and the Lynx together to provide a reconnaissance, find, and an attack platform, crewed by 2 people. That digital cockpit and all of the electronics and gadgetry on board allows a small team to find and prosecute targets, as well as providing support for people on the ground.
So just how much of a step change did the Apache bring when it was introduced?
It was a huge step change. Being able to perform all of the functions just as two crew, with a suite of sights and sensors and an arsenal of weaponry on board, allowed ultimate protection for ground call signs that were potentially under fire or in trouble.
When did you first fly an Apache Mark 1, and what was it like? What was your first impression?
So I've been operating on the Apache now for about 5 years. I stepped across after the training pipeline is conducted on a Eurocopter, a smaller helicopter, particularly lightweight, doesn't really carry any passengers. It's just two people strapped to the front of it. The step up to Apache, which is a 7 to 8 ton monster with two people sat one in front of each other, initially was completely alien. For a 7.5 ton machine, she is surprisingly agile. All the systems on board are designed to assist the pilot. So she is incredibly stable. The system allows you to fly very comfortably and to get to grips with a whole host of electronics and sensors right at your fingertips, and allows you to fly at low level in day or night, in really any weather condition.
And when you look back, or when you will look back at flying the Mark 1, what will your memories be?
I think the biggest ones for me have all been training related. However, the three big ticket items have been training in the desert in Oman and doing dust landings, firing live ordnance in the desert in the form of 30mm gun and Hellfire missiles. The next for me will be operating from ships in a maritime role on board the Prince of Wales aircraft carrier and RFA Argus. And then finally, the last thing that the Mark 1 has done is our deployment to the High North and Norway, which involves flying the aircraft in pretty austere conditions down to minus 20, minus 30 degrees. Bad snow, freezing rain, windy, but the helicopter is super capable and can deal with all of that. That last deployment has culminated in the Mark 1 out-of-service flypast, which I was lucky enough to take part in.
The Army, of course, is not going to be without Apache. It's now the next generation, the Apache 64E. So what does the E-type future hold?
I think largely the same as what the Mark 1 did. It's very much a case of an improved capability. The E model looks the same on the outside, still pretty much sounds the same, and you'd be hard pushed from a distance to tell it apart from a Mark 1. However, the analogy that I use is it's like going from your Nokia 3310 to your iPhone. On the inside, the avionics, the electronics, the sights, the sensors are an absolute step change. And the difficulty now is learning how to fully utilize everything that helicopter brings. It really is stepping into the future. And it's the first kind of improvement program of its kind that the British Army has embarked on that is now kind of at 90% completion.
You're excited about getting it, the new Apache?
Yeah, very much so. We 656 Squadron are the last people to get the E model. So it's already being flown by our sister regiment at 3 Regiment and our sister squadron, 664 Squadron within 4 Reg. So we're seeing what those guys are doing with it. We're seeing how they are deploying, again, all over the world. They've just come back from Jordan on an exercise, and Cyprus. They've just come back from Oman on a different exercise. And yeah, it'll be good to get the other side of training and really utilize that additional capability, but still performing the same role that we've been doing for the last kind of 23 years.
I bet you're itching to get going, eh?
Absolutely. Yeah, can't come soon enough.
Good luck. Really, really great to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Mike, when we think of air power, it tends to be fast jets. Are the contributions of helicopters and their crews a bit unsung?
Yes, they are a bit. I mean, I think as Major Daniel was saying there, that it's partly because they do so many different things. I mean, fast jets do what fast jets do, and it's all very glamorous. Top Gun stuff is the way the public think about it. But the helicopters are amazingly flexible. And the Apache, you know, when it was first created, the AH-64, was a bit like the Soviet, the Mi-24, the Hind helicopter. They look a bit similar and they do the same sort of job. But whereas the Soviet version was very heavy and relatively inflexible, the Apache was extremely flexible and, as he said, did lots of other things. You know, when you look at the Chinook, of course, I mean, the Chinook helicopter has done an amazing range of things. You know, the Chinooks can get to places that you'd be astonished an airframe that big could get into and get out of, and they've been used as all sorts of things. And my favourite version of the Chinook is that for a while they became gunships. I mean, huge gunships in Vietnam. And the crews knew them as Guns A Go Go. That's what they call them, Guns A Go Go.
Yeah. I was going to ask, have you ever been in Apache?
No, sadly not. When I was getting helicopter trips, it was always on earlier generation helicopters. And I remember going into one of the little Wasp helicopters, you know, the little things that you used to see on American cop serials, you know, just a little bubble with a rotor on the back. And I remember the pilot saying to me, do you know what happens if you lose the engine? I said, it's the sycamore leaf effect, isn't it? He said, oh yeah, should we see? And he cut the engine and we dropped like a stone. But the point is that as you drop the air, you know, you're dropping so fast that the air makes the rotor turn, and so you land. Oh. He said, so you can always come into land, he said, but you only get one bite of the cherry. And we did. Yeah. We did get our one bite of the cherry, and I, you know, my stomach was somewhere still above us when we actually gently got onto the ground.
There are old pilots and there are bold pilots, but there are no old bold pilots, hey Mike?
That's what they say.
Yeah. Thanks so much, and thanks to all of our guests. That's all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. Until then, you can always catch up with past programmes you might have missed online at bfbs.com/SITREP, the Forces News YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.